Russ did a great job of introducing, so I won't take as much time to make introductory comments, except I'm just kind of real impressed. I mean, for one thing, we're following Gary Henry. I mean, that's kind of hard enough, right? Like, it's back-to-back week, and we're not real preachers. That's the rest of the story, and we really don't aspire to do this for a living or as kind of some kind of career. We've just been asked to do it, and I would say reluctantly agreed. It's been our feeling that this ought to be something that the elders in churches, or if there aren't, the members are asking us to come and actually helping direct and shape these sessions for the benefit of the flock in those places. That's their job to do that. So that's why we're here. So I guess I'm just impressed with your interest in this topic. That'd be the best way to describe it. I really do want to hear from everybody. So I'm kind of a teacher by heart and early on. So, and the other thing is, my brain cannot keep up with my mouth. So, if I can stop talking for a minute and let it catch up, that would be helpful too. All right. So let's review. We're going to talk about two kinds of shepherd. You remember what they're called? Flock shepherding and sheep shepherding. I can't really prove that's a Bible concept. Like, I can show that both of those kinds of duties are there are examples of that in the New Testament. So I'll just apologize and ask you to go along with us for the next 2 or 3 days and think about flock shepherding and sheep shepherding as two kinds of different concepts. Do you think they overlap? Okay, that's kind of my lesson this tonight. But yes, but here's a quick definition. And that is, flock shepherding is leadership of a group of Christians, a local church. Sheep shepherding is individual Christians. So let's practice. Which would this be? Deciding what to do with the collection. That'd be flock shepherding, right? Which would this be? Counseling a young student on the way they ought to dress. Sheep shepherding, right? What about disciplining a member? What? Okay. In what sense is it? I think we understand how it's sheep shepherding, right? Because there's a person whose soul, you're trying to bring them back. That's what you're trying to do, as admonish them as a brother and that kind of. But 1 Corinthians 5 model says, you know, deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. The whole idea is to save their soul, right? How is it a flock shepherding thing? Teaching whom? The rest of the flock. In fact, in that passage, 1 Corinthians 5, there's a kind of an image that has to do with the flock, which is what? What's that image? You remember? I'll give you a hint. A little bit of this stuff has an effect. Leaven. Leaven is kind of a collective thing, a flock thing, isn't it? A little leaven will spread through the whole flock. So is it the case that discipline has a purpose for a specific sheep, but it has a protective function, really, for the group as a whole? So no question they overlap. I'm not trying to say they don't. But just for organizing our thoughts, we want to just talk about flock shepherding as a certain set of skills and sheep shepherding as a certain set of skills. They relate to each other. In fact, that's kind of the bottom line of my lesson. You'll see that when I get to that point. And the other thing that I would just, the only other introductory thing is, we really are not going to talk about the qualifications of elders. I think that whenever a congregation gets ready to appoint elders, what's the first thing you do? Gary, you did this because I listened to all your lessons online. What do you talk about? Go to the qualifications and you work through them. And some of them are tricky, aren't they? And there's what's husband of one wife, you know, or you know, how many kids I have and how old and how long and what's, you know, riding and unruly. You know what I'm talking about. We're not dealing with that. For sure we're not dealing with that. And the reason is partly because that's really not the work of the shepherd. That's the qualification of the shepherd. The skills you need, maybe those qualifications help you, but they're a work you have to do. And I'll say more about that in just a minute. Okay, so here's some examples of passages. We should probably review that too, so everybody feels like they've learned some facts. Besides those two passages, 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1. What are key passages that talk about the work of a shepherd or the role of a shepherd? Russ has made reference to them over and over, and we'll keep doing that. Can you remember the fives? There's actually only four of them, but they're about fives. 1 Peter 5. 1 Timothy 5, which is after the qualifications, but it talks about a little bit the ruling well, double honor, that kind of thing. Okay. What's that? James 5 is one verse there, but you know, the sick kind of. What else? Okay, wait, that's not a five. 1 Thessalonians 5, that's it. So we got those. Now we got the Hebrews one, right? That's the lucky passage in Hebrews 13. right? But it's got 7 and 17 in it, so that makes it lucky, right? So Hebrews 13, there's actually a reference to verse 24 as well. But so Hebrews 13 and one other one that's kind of important, Acts 20, and we'll look at that one in particular in detail. There are other references, as Russ mentioned, but those are ones in which you really get a sense of how the congregation should look at the shepherd, what the work is, and so on. And I'm making a distinction between the experience and skills which develop as a man serves as an elder and the qualifications themselves. Y'all, I think you'll appreciate that as we go through. Probably already understand that well. So here's references to the flock. You realize the flock is a singular word, isn't it? But I think in English, my son's an English major, but I think we would say it's a collective noun. It's singular, but it represents a collection of things. So is church, by the way, right? And body ends up having that same concept too, because the body is made up of many members in that imagery. So there's a collective sense, but you see this singular word in both of these passages, Acts 20 and 1 Peter 5. Here's my outline. I think we have to understand what the church, the local assembly, is and does before we really understand what the leaders of that collective group do. All right. So this lesson is on flock shepherding. Here's another review question. Of the two things, which is the real work of an elder? Sheep shepherding. That's our theme. We'll keep saying that over and over. Russ already kind of spilled the beans. It's the bottom line. It's the last thing I'll say Sunday morning. That's the message, right? So I have to do a lesson on the flock shepherding first. But you'll see that's the key thing. But I want to talk about the misconceptions of that collective group, because I think if we misunderstand that, we'll not understand what the work of an elder is with regard to the group activities. Look at what a church does. What is the leader's work in that? By the way, New Testament examples for all of those. And finally, how does the flock support this leadership? I want to talk about some misconceptions of the church. Now, this first one is unfortunate. It's like, I thought it was such a great illustration, but I just learned at supper that you don't have inspection stations here in Kentucky. Do y'all know what inspection stations are? Somebody have been, you know, I guess y'all just send your pollution right on down into Tennessee. Right? But is that right? So, but you get the idea that, what do? You take your car down, you get out your $20 bill, you pay some guy to, measure your carbon monoxide or something. And if it passes, then he gives you a certificate and then you get your car registered. You used to do that every year in Georgia. You know what I'm talking about? Well, okay. Do you have driver's license here? Sometimes, after you get over 13, you get, right. So, but you understand what I mean by this. This is a thing you have to do. Is it the most fun thing in your life? It's a chore. It's a duty. And you have to do it. And it's not really all that pleasant. The more pleasant it is, the better, for sure. But that doesn't mean you want to do it a bunch of times, right? And so, you go do it. You have to. You punch your ticket. You get your kind of certification or sticker. It used to be a sticker. But you can do that. And what I want is, I have to go for obligation. I want to measure success by efficiency, right? If I have to go back a second time and get it inspected another time, do you think I'm happy about that? Sometimes if your car doesn't pass, you got to go get work done on it, come back, see if it passes. I don't like that. Fewer times, the better. And, it's rarely the case that I go get it inspected. I say, man, that was so fun. I'm going to go back again in 3 months. Instead of waiting for a whole year. Think of your driver's license the same way. How many of you got like a 5-year license maybe? You don't go back after 3 just because it's so much fun. I can't wait to get back down there, and take the test. You don't do that. Furthermore, when I get my car inspected, I'm not a changed man. It doesn't change my life the rest of the week. I've just gotten my duty done. Y'all see that? Now, if that's your view of the local church, nobody would really think that, would they? Come on Sunday, probably nobody here would think that. But, nobody would say it out loud. You come on Sunday, do the Lord's Supper thing. Sunday night, that's too much. And I'm not really much different after the services are over and the rest of the week. But I've done my duty. I've checked that thing off at the inspection station. Now, how would I measure a local church if that was my view of its function? Kind of like a, punch the clock kind of thing. How would I measure the success of that church? Sorry? Yeah, who all came, got their tickets punched. But as an individual coming to that church, how would I measure how good that church was? Pardon? Yeah, but why would a lot of people come if this is the kind of view of the church? It's just kind of come out of duty, you have to do it once a week. Pardon? Yeah, maybe how I feel. Although I tell you, I'm kind of neutral about getting my car inspected, right? We'll talk about how it feels in the next misconception, but what I want it to be efficient, start on time, right? For sure, end on time. I mean, we got to beat the Baptist to the cafeteria, right? You know what I'm saying? It's got to be efficient. It's got to be something that really gets... Now, don't cut anything short. Keep it scriptural. I got to get my certification. But let's be efficient. Good parking, pay parking lot, comfortable building, nice pews, professional preachers. You know, okay, but you get the idea. You get it done. And so leaders of that group would be judged this way. Is the group efficient, organized? Are they sensitive to my busy life outside of this particular piece, right? Are they sensitive to that? And am I getting an adequate religious experience? Okay, a better misconception, still a misconception, is this idea of a common interest club. I remember when I was a kid, they had garden clubs. I think my mom was in that. I think it had to do with, like, keeping your yard or something. I don't know. But it was a thing where people who shared an interest would come together and discuss that. And, you know, there are clubs like that today. Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America. Have you heard? I mean, anybody in that group? I was going to ask you to pronounce the acronym if you could. But you know what I'm talking about. This is a club of people that actually like the same things. And they would really like to participate and learn about that. In fact, they'd really like to encourage other people to like that same thing. They might even recruit people to come and learn how to do barbershop quartet singing. Y'all know what I mean? And I come together and I share that thing. And as a church, sometimes, you know, we really like studying the Bible. In some way, we're a society for the preservation and encouragement of Bible study in America, aren't we? You think about that, and we like it. In fact, we'd like to have really good Bible teachers, right? And we'd like to actually sing. Oh, we love to sing. We have special services just for singing because we like that. So we want to all be together and do the things that we like to do. Do you see that? Now, if that was my view of the church, I would want to have a pleasant experience. I want a professional preacher who provides this thing that I like and good singing, right? And I would measure the success of that group by the quality and comfort. And I wouldn't have much tolerance for somebody that was causing trouble. If somebody was in the Society for the Preservation of Barbershop and they were always causing trouble and keeping us from doing our quartet singing, what would our attitude be toward that person? Why are you even here? Get out. So we wouldn't have much tolerance for discomfort or things that go wrong or things that are difficult or that things require a lot of effort beyond the things that we like, which is what we're there for. You see that as a misconception? If I were a leader of a group like that, here's what I would, you know, be judged by, I think. Is it a pleasant experience? Am I getting that thing that we like to do? Good Bible study, good singing. And am I good at recruiting and keeping the group together to do what it has to do? In our free enterprise system, it's often the case, though, that a church is judged and compared to a business. Isn't that true? Because that's kind of our model of organization. In fact, if you think about the models of leadership, you go buy a book on the shelf about leadership, what's it most likely going to be about? A Bill Gates, right? Steve Jobs, Jack Welch, somebody like that. There may be some books on leadership at a more general level, but they're generally taking their models from that. Before that, the business world of the last century would have been military leaders would be the models we would look to for leadership. But businesses are often a misconception that we're something like a business. If this were a business enterprise, how do businesses measure success, by the way? This is not hard. It's a number. It's a profit, bottom line. Or it could be growth, or it could be return on net assets, or EBITDA, or it could be the brand recognition. But you see, these are measures that people can go out and do surveys and do their math and calculate those numbers, and that's the way businesses measure success. So let me ask you another question about a business. Suppose you hire somebody and they don't produce anything. What would you do? Well, you might try to train them, but you know the HR laws require you to go. But really, what if you hired them and they were not only didn't produce, they were counterproductive? They did damage. They produced scrap and rework. Then what would you do? You'd really get rid of them quickly, right? Find a way to do it. As a matter of fact, if you could run a business with less labor and produce the same amount, what would you do? You would do that. Yeah, good answer, right? In fact, if in the extreme, if I could have a business that had no labor costs at all, This is like licensing software or something. Y'all understand that humans are on the wrong side of the balance sheet, right? They're a cost. They're not the thing we're producing. They're the thing that kind of, in a way, on the balance sheet, they're negatives. They get in the way. You see, that's what a business would be. So if you thought of the church this way, you would measure the church by, are we growing? Are we bigger? Do we have more people? Do we have more brand recognition in the community? You'd measure a leader based on that as well. And you wouldn't have tolerance for non-productive or counterproductive members. And if you had a leader, you'd be looking at results. And you'd see if he was a strong direction setter and a visionary and exercising positive control and charismatic and keeping people motivated and so on. One thing that strikes me about the qualifications of elders, see, now we will talk about them just for a minute, is how boring they are. Have you thought about that? I think there's at least five, in, if I counted right, in 1 Timothy 3, that are just not something. Not a novice. Not quarrelsome. Not greedy. Right? In the old language, I think it's not, what's a striker? No striker. Not a brawler. These are what they're not. They're only, they're the husband of only one wife, you know. They are blameless. These are things that they're not. They're kind of boring people. Do you hear any of these? Decisive, charismatic, efficient, quality and cost conscious, organized, aggressive, brilliant, consumer, action oriented, growth oriented, smart, energetic, creative, visionary, proactive. Are these in the text? They're really not. And yet when we look at the leaders sometimes and we're thinking, boy, he'd make a good elder. Are we thinking about a model like this maybe in terms of what the church is and does? We need to be careful about that. I think an elder is persuasive, and the one I can find says he's able to convict the gainsayer, right? He's familiar enough with the word to convince people about the truth. Titus in particular talks about that role after the qualifications. But elders are pretty stable, kind of not too exciting people. In some ways, if you think of the model like these things here. So, not an inspection station, not a club for common interest, Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Bible Study in America, right? And certainly not a business. Those are wrong models of leadership. So now that leaves the main question, which is, what is it? What is the church? What is the model of leadership? And so I think we'll sneak up on that a little bit by looking at what a church does. And I'd like to ask you this question. What does a church do? And I'll make the question even narrower and say that it's things that we would do when we're all gathered together. You know what I mean? What are the things that Christians did? We have New Testament examples. What do we do when we're assembled together under the same roof? Right.
Sing.
Lord's Supper. Right, so the five things. This is a hint. Everybody got that, right? So we know those are the five things that churches do when they assemble together. So I'll bring them up here. Pray, sing, observe, listen to teaching and preaching, gather money for needy Christians. Are there other things you can think of that a church did in the New Testament? And I'll narrow the question to be when they were together in the same building in the same place, apparently. Maybe they were outside, but they were all together. Right? List some things. I mean, I mean by that, you have to give me a specific Bible example, a text. Okay, what did they do there? They were all together. He said, really, with the whole church. My spirit with you, he says, right? You'll remember that, 1 Corinthians 5. Man had his brother's, his father's wife. And they were supposed to gather together in the sight of all. Kind of one of those, I'm sorry, that's the elders that sin. But there's another one. I just spilled the beans on that one. In our 1 Timothy 5, elders that sin reprove where? In the sight of all. It's almost as though that's a congregational type thing. That the rest may be in fear, if you remember that path. There's effect of the flock. What else did they do all together? These are good answers. Okay, what were they doing that for? It was in the context of a decision or an action they were taking. Yeah. So Acts chapter 13, they actually prayed and fasted, and then they sent these men. Apparently, now the Holy Spirit helped with that decision, and yet it was a congregational action to send these men out. And by the way, go one chapter forward. What happened when they finished that? They probably didn't call it the first missionary journey, but when they finished that, what did they do? Did they all come together for that? Yeah, they did, actually. It says they all came together and they heard the report of these missionaries that had been sent out by that church there in Antioch. I'm going to make a parenthesis statement here. Do you know that there's more Bible verses about these kinds of congregational meetings that we're talking about, discipline, preachers hearing reports and those kind of things than there are about when to take the Lord's Supper. I'm not going to go into some heresy here about taking. But do you understand, if you want to talk about what Christians did and Bible examples, and so the elders call a congregational meeting, I suppose that's what all this paperwork is up here. Do you realize there are more Bible verses about this kind of thing? Bible verses, I'm not saying more authority, but then maybe the Lord's Supper. Think about it. You can argue with me afterwards, I guess, but y'all see what I'm getting at. Think about what are some other things they did gathered together? Exactly. There were several things going on. Did they have a debate there? I mean, I call it whatever. They discussed the right and wrong of the thing. There's apparently some people took an alternate view. James and Peter and others presented arguments based on apostolic authority, Old Testament scripture, and so on. And then, once that was done, they had another discussion. Apparently as a whole group, because it says the saying pleased the whole multitude. So what did they decide after they decided? I wouldn't say decided, but after they presented the truth on this issue about Gentiles. Yeah, they thought about that. In fact, apparently that pleased the group. That's a good idea. Not only send the letter, but also send some men with the letter back down to Antioch. Was that a congregational decision? It apparently, okay, elders and apostles leading it for sure, but they all agree, yeah, this is what we're going to do. This is a good thing. And there was a sense of almost like rejoicing that this is a good plan. We're going to do that. And when the letter got to Antioch, guess what happened? They got together again as a group. And read the letter and rejoiced for something, Okay? What else? Okay? To love and good works. And we always think of that. Well, surely these things will take care of that. But is there more than that? There's all kinds of things that happen. As a matter of fact, you might even think about the time that we're together as a core of some other things that are going on. I wouldn't say that they're the primary thing, but there's certainly effects. James 2. So what happens when a rich or a poor man comes into your assembly and he's treated a certain way by the group, right? Are you showing something by the way you treat that brother about your attitude? Can you think of another passage? 1 Corinthians 14. Ignorant unbelieving, one translation say, a man comes into the group. He's an unbeliever, but he comes into the group. 1 Corinthians 14, in the context of exercising spiritual gifts, and people are acting wacky. They're out of control. What's that man going to conclude? Do you remember that text? Yeah, you're nuts. But on the other hand, if he sees reverence and the Spirit's under the control of the prophets, what's he going to conclude? He'll fall down to worship and say, God is among you. That's what the text said. So you're teaching by example. That's something we do. Now, you can see that's kind of a side effect of the worship, but it's another thing the church does together. They're teaching by example. Outsiders, rich and poor, unbelievers who come in the assembly. So that's yet another thing. There are probably others, and I have a long list. I think we've thought of most of them here. Oh, we skipped Acts 6. Remember that? What happened in Acts 6? They were being neglected, apparently. And we don't know if the problem was as bad as the Greeks thought it was. It doesn't matter. It was perceived to be a pretty serious problem, and they met the apostles there, selected men to deacon tables. And actually, they didn't select them. They asked the group to select them. So there's another congregational activity, right? Then they appointed over the matter, and that was solved. And then they came back and announced, this is what we're going to do. And what was the effect on the group? They pleased the whole multitude. I don't know if that's every single person, but there was kind of a group attitude about it. This is a good thing, they said. This solves the problem. Okay, so the first one we didn't have. Select appointed workers for that. Jesus foreshadowed, I think, the operation of the church when he said, take the matter to the church. That's a place where a brother you think has sinned against you. Initiate, explain discipline. We talked about reprove elders that sin in the sight of all. Discuss issues. Welcome visitors. Teach unbelievers about orderly worship. Announce decisions and give feedback. This has to do with the letter and so on. Select and appoint workers to go elsewhere and then hear their reports when they get back. That's a pretty good list, isn't it? Well beyond the five of things that a group does together. And when you think about the leaders of the group, these are the kinds of things they'll be leading in. The kind of work the church will be doing, you see. Okay. Now, their congregational decisions and actions are kind of mostly from the same group. But now, not necessarily when they're gathered together, but something that as a group they did. They dealt with complaints. They selected men for office and duties. They decided to allow a man to join the church. Russ mentioned this, review. Who is it they decided could join the church in Jerusalem? Imagine, the Apostle Paul, Saul, coming to say, could I be a member here? And so that's, but they had to, there was a work to be done, and it had to be considered. The leaders had to do that. Settle disputes between members. I think the implication in 1 Corinthians 6 is there's two brothers, and they've got some kind of problem. Maybe it's a business matter. It might be a debt, because he says, wouldn't it be better if you were just defrauded? Maybe he means by that lost some money or something. Who are they supposed to go to sort that out, rather than before unbelievers in the legal system? Yeah, he actually is more specific about he says, wise, are there not wise men among you? So you would find someone in the church who was wise, who could sort that issue out, even though it may not be necessarily about sin. It might be more of a business matter. I certainly think, by the way, that a divorce case, which should never happen in the first place, but going before unbelievers over a matter like that, it seems like there ought to be wise men among you, and rather than going before the law, maybe be defrauded, would certainly fall into that category. Euodia and Syntyche, remember those two ladies? And who was told to help them sort that out? That's church work. That's collective work. Recruiting and hosting a preacher. It's interesting, this little detail in 1 Corinthians 16. Paul says, you know, I talked to Apollos about coming to preach for you. I'm making some of that up, but he couldn't come right now. On the other hand, I'm sending Timothy to you. See that he be among you without fear. So they may not have wanted Timothy, but that's who they got, right? They wanted Apollos, and he couldn't come. But still, do you see that they were thinking about who would they would like to come and work with them and be a part of their group? Debated doctrinal issues, sending a doctrinal letter, supporting men to sin, committing money to the needy. We didn't mention that. It doesn't say they were gathered together, but Paul implies in 2 Corinthians 8, you, collective you, have made a commitment. And you're going to look bad against that commitment, and especially against these other churches that gave themselves first, if you don't live up to that. Can a church make a commitment to a need like that? Seems to be what he's saying. And he's saying you better live up to it. So that's another thing a congregation does. Selecting men to carry the gifts. 1 Corinthians 16 says collect it up. But when I come and we go, you're going to pick somebody. I don't want to even pick the man. But you're going to pick somebody as a representative of your group to carry this money. So that we'll do all things that are honorable in the sight. We'll do things that are honorable in the sight of all men. Y'all see the point I'm making here. There's a lot of things to do besides the fact five acts of worship. In that setting, and Russ has mentioned this, that in the book of Acts, the role of the apostle starts off really high. Seems like, you know, in the shepherding role for the church in Jerusalem. And then it diminishes toward the end. And then starting in chapter 11, the role of the elders increases. In the middle, you see them both together. Acts 15 is apostles and elders seem like acting together. And then near the end, it's interesting, the last mention is in chapter 21, where the apostle Paul is kind of blocked at the door, right, by the elders of the church for the sake of the flock, aren't they? They're protecting the flock from the reputation Paul had, probably unfairly, about his view of the old law. But anyway, here are some things that elders did. They distributed the gifts. They considered doctrinal questions. They chose men. They sent a letter to other churches. They had an elders meeting. We'll talk about that in just a minute. In Miletus, it was actually an offsite, turns out, and they had a consultant in the person of Apostle Paul. They made plans to avoid problems. We just mentioned that. They gave gifts, whatever that means, that were, you know, given to Timothy by the laying on of the hands of the presbytery, you know, whatever that means. It may have been a special assignment or a special opportunity, but there was some role there. James 5, they anointed the sick and prayed for the sick and so on. Okay, Russ mentioned the advantage of having men to make decisions. One answer to that question about what it Theophilus, what did Theophilus think Luke meant in chapter 11 when he said they laid it at the feet of the elders? What do you think what's his name again? Theophilus. What did Theophilus think an elder was, you think? What's that? Older men. Do you think he would have an idea? So Russ mentioned, well, maybe he was actually in a church where there were elders already. Remember, Acts wasn't written in chapter 11. It was written, you know, later, I guess chapter 37 or something. But, you know, it was after the end of the book. But still, the term is just introduced as if he's supposed to know what that is. And I think the reason that he knows what that is elders have been a phenomenon through the entire history of God's people. When you go to the book of Genesis even, there's a reference to elders in Egypt when they went to bury Joseph's dad, Jacob. And when Moses goes back in Exodus chapter 3 to talk the Israelites into letting him lead them out of Egypt, who does he go to? He goes to the elders. Elders of, you know, I guess families or something. When Moses organized things in the wilderness, he chose older men to handle the matters and so on. Even in the time of Jesus, there were the chief priests and elders. There, in the Jewish system, there was a sense of older men. That's been a common plan that God has had from the beginning. And I think it even spans beyond the Israelites. It's just been a sensible thing when a group of people are together that those who have the larger experience in life are chosen and selected and even given some authority to make these decisions. What are advantages in that besides the fact that it's God's plan? Well, first of all, it gets things done. If it's even a totally arbitrary decision, sometimes the more smart people you have in the room, highly motivated, what happens to the decision? It gets harder, isn't it? If you got a bunch of people, they all have different experiences. They may be all brilliant. In fact, it's probably worse if they're brilliant because they have brilliant ideas, right? And so it's hard to... But if you have somebody who can make it, even if it's judgment, even if it's arbitrary, it's very efficient the way that works. But I think it's more than that. It's kind of the initiative. You know, when everyone's in charge, really who's in charge? And so when the roof's about to leak, and you know, there's no one to say, hey, I think we should fix it before it leaks, then you know, you have someone who's responsible to take the initiative to get ahead of the group instead of having just kind of an open responsibility. But I think the decisions for the flock overseeing go a little deeper than that. And I think there's an inherent priority or expediency about the things that are decided. Some interesting passages to think about in this regard. 1 Corinthians, I'll look at chapter 10, verse 23. All things are lawful, but not all things are edifying or helpful or whatever you want to say. There are some things it's okay to do. And by the way, this is in the context of eating meats. And was it absolutely wrong to eat meats if it maybe came from an idol's temple? What's the teaching there? Absolutely wrong on the ledger of sin? No. Idol's not anything. We know that. And yet, was there judgment that would make it wrong? Poor judgment in some cases? Yes. And that's the whole point of that whole text. And Paul gives examples of whether he should marry or not, or whether he should take support when he was preaching. Is that okay to do? He argues it is. But he says it's not the wisest thing to do. Why? Because there are bigger goals. There are more important things. There are things that are edifying and other things that are not. And that's the role of an elder, making decisions in the church to sort out between it's legal, we could do that. And on the other hand, boy, we want to build up. We want to edify. We don't want to cause anyone to stumble, right? We want to teach with our work. You see the difference there between that and just an arbitrary decision. And you want men who are qualified to think broadly about the effect on the flock and about the trends and about the consequences of decisions, similar to, I think, decisions about eating meats and so on, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 10. These two passages down below, there we go. The 1 Timothy 5 is actually about widows indeed. And he says, if any believing woman has widows, let her relieve them that what? The church is not burdened. What does that imply about the work of, or the priority in the church's work? Is it the widows or is it something else? Yeah, it seems to be saying if an individual, especially family, can take care of this issue, they should do that. That the church be not burden, that's a pretty strong word. It's almost like we'd rather not the church have to do any of that because it has some other stuff that's really important to do. Think about Acts 6. When the apostles said, we want to appoint some deacons, men to deacon tables, that's the verb there. What is the reason for that? You remember from Acts 6? Why were they wanting those men to do that? But so the apostles would be free. You mean something more important than visiting the widows in the hospital for an elder to do? I know they were apostles, but they'll say prototypical elders. Something more important than visiting the widows in their work? That's one thing. And what else? Prayer and the word is what it says. Are you telling me that the apostles, it was more important for them to be preaching and praying than it was for them to be feeding widows? I think that's what they said. I think that's what they said in the text. The point being, there are decisions that are not just expedient, they're actually a priority in the church's work. And those are things that have to be done. So the advantage of overseer with a spiritual view will be able to find those things that will build the church up in the way it needs to be built up, in the mission that it has been given to do. I feel like I'm just leaving huge potholes to be misunderstood. Do y'all see what I'm getting at? I'm not saying it's wrong to for the church to support benevolent causes. But I am saying it is not our primary work. And if there are those who can do it on an individual basis, they should do it. And that's because their priorities are in order. So leaders have to have that view of what the church is about. And it isn't about social causes. It's about teaching and preaching and praying and the edifying of people by the word. Okay. I want to talk about two passages, and they're in our list. So, I don't know if Ephesians 4 made our list or not, but it's about pastors and teachers. But it's a picture of what the church does. And as we've, at Embry Hills, a lot of times, we always come back to this text. It's almost like it draws you back to it because of what it says. It's a little bit of a charter statement for what a church should do. And I want to kind of work through it, maybe diagram it in a picture, and try to put these two concepts of the flock and the sheep shepherding together. If you back up to verse 8 in this text, there's a quote from, I think it's Psalm 68, which is kind of a... But anyway, Paul borrows... It's a military-type psalm, but Paul borrows the language there, I think, and he says that there are gifts given. And God has given gifts to mankind, the psalm says. But here he says, on down to verse 11, he gave some gifts to the church. He gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers. Do we still have apostles and prophets today? This is a trick question before you answer. Do we still have apostles and prophets today as gifts to the church?
Yes.
How do we still have them today?
Through the Word.
That's what they did. They delivered. Okay, but they're not alive. Okay, so that's the rest of that question. Evangelists, pastors, and teachers. Do we have those today in the flesh? Yes, we do. So these are gifts. They're things that God has put in place to help. And Russ mentioned that passage. It would not be profitable for you to do this, you know, cause grief. Because you're not getting the advantage that these elders could provide. I'm sorry, I'm not in front of you too much. So, they're gifts to the church for what? I'll just read the text now. For the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Kind of a chain there. Till we all come to the unity of the faith, the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That purpose, we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness by which they lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things to Him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by that which every joint supplies, according to effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Boy, if you just tease that apart, there's just a lot there, but I'm just going to try to draw a simple picture. And so we'll skip over some of the words that are in there. First of all, he says these are gifts, verse 8 and verse 11, and that includes pastors or elders. They're part of that picture of what's been provided to the church. For what? Well, for the equipping of the saints. Now, when I get to that, I'm not too much smarter than I was before.
Right.
I'm going to give you a toolbox, and you ask me to do what? Well, I say to do the work of the ministry. Okay? Begs another question, right? So what work is it? So what follows then is a description of the work that would have to be done. He says we're going to edify the body. Once again, a collective term that has parts to it. Members. Remember 1 Corinthians 12. The body has many members and they all have different roles, but it's a collective term. I'm going to build that thing up. I'm going to build it up. That's what edifying means. I'm going to build it up. And he talks about in particular, till everyone, maybe every part of that, and as a group, there's a unity of the faith. You remember what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1 about all being of the same mind and the same spirit. Wouldn't that be an ideal state in a church? That everybody was thinking the same way about things and they had the same attitude toward everything? Is that ever really the case? Not in this world, I'm afraid. It isn't possible because we have new Christians and we have some that are struggling and others, and then there's just this plain old, we're all learning. We're never finished in our growing in this life. But our goal is that, all to have this unity of the faith. And he says, to the knowledge that will bring you to be a perfect man, verse 13. And he says that you'll be, so that, you'll be no longer children. I'm going to think about that. First of all, it brings to mind an image. Now, remember our bad images? The inspection station. Can you remember what they are? Inspection station. A club for common interest and a business or corporation. We're kind of getting close to a better one here. Children, what image does that bring to mind? It's a family. And Russ had talked about that. These are children. It says we It says that they could be easily tossed to and fro. Do you understand there's a protective function? That there's deception. There's a wind of doctrine. There are people who are seductive in their teaching. And we need to protect those children, don't we? And it says, actually, no longer, but he says, you may grow up in all things. Right? So they're not just... So I want to ask this question. Do we want children in the church? Because he says, no longer children. Do we want children? You know what I mean by children. I don't mean, you know, toddlers, physical toddlers, but I mean immature Christians. Do we want them in the church? Yes, we do. In fact, the function here is to help them grow up. Do we want people to stay children, though? So you see, that's the idea. There's a family picture here, and in our own families, we want babies, right? But I'll just tell you what, they're a lot of trouble. Corporations don't hire babies and pay them full salaries. Right? Because they're not productive. They're counterproductive. In fact, in a family, they keep you up all night. And they take a lot of resources. And they make a lot of noise. And they cause people to lose sleep. Does that make us mad? No, because what's a family for? Protect that baby. Help it grow up. It'll go off to college one day. Or somewhere. Right? That's the goal. That it grows up. And so what you have is a picture then of a family that's helping a child. You might say it's unfortunate it's a child, but really, no, that's our goal, is to take children who need to be protected, and they're easily deceived, and we surround them and teach them, and finally they grow up. And that's what the role of the church is. So you see that picture of rearing children. So really, if you draw a circle around that, those are individual goals. That's like, in a way, sheep shepherding, isn't it? I see a baby child or a baby Christian, if you want to say, and I help them. I protect them as an individual, right? And then he goes on to say, almost like a balancing of the front and the back, he says that we're all knit together through that which every joint supplies, the building up of the body in love. That's almost the same words that he used at the beginning of the text. You understand that's kind of like this whole unity thing. And it's something that every single joint, I believe that may not be every single member, it may mean every relationship between every member. That's the joint between people. And the love and the unity, that's the surrounding environment in which these children are protected and developed to grow up. This right. So if I draw a circle around that, there's the flock shepherd. Now, do you see a relationship between the flock shepherding and the sheep shepherding? What's the real goal again? It's getting everyone to heaven, right? Watching on behalf of individual souls. We're saved as individual souls, right? And yet the group activity, the unity, right? The love, the participation and training of every joint. That's what makes this cocoon work. This incubator for babies to work in the family. So that's really a better picture. You see how that would work. Okay, I'm trying to give you a better picture than an inspection station or club or a business. So what does a church leader do? And to talk about this, I'd like to turn to Acts chapter 20 and just look at this text a little closer. And here's why. I just want you to know that Paul says, y'all remember Acts 20, what's the context again? Pardon? He's speaking to Ephesian elders. Funny how Ephesus keeps showing up. And they're in the book of Revelation. But that's where Timothy was working, remember, as an evangelist. And that's where the qualifications in 1 Timothy 3 were given to. It's part of that. But anyway, so Paul is coming back from his third journey. He's in a hurry. The elders come down. How many elders were there at Ephesus? I don't know. Yeah, more than one. Just I don't think there were just two. Actually, in my own imagination, I suspect there were maybe half a dozen or maybe even a dozen or more. I don't know why I think that. I just know that they made a big trip down there, and he says from among your own number. I don't know why I think number is a high number, but you know, but there's enough of them that some of them might turn bad, you know, over time. I don't know, but I think it was a substantially sized group, but I made that part up. I'm sorry for that. But Paul says to them, this is interesting. Remember, this is a meeting of all Christians, or it's elders. He's talking to elders, this is not a sermon to the church. He says, verse 18, when they come to him, he said to them, you know, from the first day that I came to Asia, in what manner I always lived among you. Why is he bringing his own life example up to them? Is he just defending his apostleship? He does that in other places. Is there a reason he's bringing his own life up to them? Verse 31. Therefore watch and remember that for 3 years I did not cease to warn everyone night and day with tears. Why is he bringing his own life example up? Isn't that it? Isn't that pretty clear? And look down at verse 35. By the way, they said they needed to emulate his example. Verse 35. I'm reading New King James. It's even stronger in other translations. But I've shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must. And he goes on to say what that is. You see that? He brought them to say, you've got to do this. And he talks about all the things that he had done. In fact, let's look at some of the things then. If he's their example, what are some of the things he did? Well, first of all, the goal of the work, I think you can kind of see, first of all, verse 26 by almost like reverse implication is, he is worried about Christians dying. He says, I'm innocent of the blood of all men. Why? Why is Paul himself personally innocent for the blood of... if these people die or are injured in some fatal way, why is Paul innocent of that blood? This is a spiritual metaphor, of course, but why? Because he did his best. He said everything he could to them. I have not shunned to declare to you the whole counsel of God. Comic relief break here. So we were at a church one time, and there was a visiting preacher, and apparently he had just a whole bunch of hobbies that he didn't get to preach on very much, and he got them all in this lesson, and it went forever. Not that I don't have anything against a long sermon, but anyway, it's a long lesson. The man leading the closing prayer, this is not a joke, I mean it is a joke, but it really happened, said, we're so thankful that brother so-and-so could be with us today to declare unto us the whole counsel of God, and so on. Okay, I'm sorry, I won't do that. But Paul said, I did that. He said, I did not shun to declare the whole... Why? Because you need that to protect you from death and so on. So if you go down to verse 29, he says, I know this. After my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing. This is serious. And you saw this in Ephesians 4. It's protective. Remember the children that were easily tossed to and fro? Paul says, I did everything I could. I labored night and day. I taught you the whole counsel of God. Everything I could do to protect you. And that's what I want you to emulate. He's telling the elders who came from the church at Ephesus for what they should do. So what are some of the things that he did? Well, I'll just say, so we said it's protective. It's also able to build you up. Verse 32. Doesn't that sound like children growing up in Ephesians 4? The same idea? Where they're not unstable or vulnerable, but they become strong and sturdy and can stand against that. And finally, he says, we're aiming for an inheritance among all the sanctified. Doesn't that remind you, watch in behalf of your souls, or when the chief shepherd appears in 1 Peter 5? These are languages of hope that if we make it through this battle now, we'll have the reward at the end. That's what Paul was telling these elders was their mission, really, and what was doing. So what did he do? Here are some things. Verse 20, he proclaimed everything that was helpful. Everything that could possibly... By the way, this is a thing to note as we go through, but maybe we'll say it out loud too. How much of the elders' work is centered around teaching and the Word? I would almost say everything. Even counseling, even making judgmental decisions. I think it's right to ask, are there any Bible principles we can call to mind that will help us with this? And what teaching can be done to help us through this issue? I think we think of, well, once again, if you have a business model, you want a guy with a great financial mind or a good architect to make sure the building gets expanded efficiently. No. This is Word work. And you'll see that the Word is at the heart of what the elder does and how he rules in all this. I mean, anyway, Paul begins that way. I proclaimed everything publicly and from house to house. Does that sound familiar? Publicly is like with groups and house to house is with individuals. That kind of sounds a little like flock and sheep, doesn't it? He worked both ways, in a public setting and in house to house. Which is the harder and most important? House to house problem, the one-on-one relationships. Take heed to yourself. I won't go into that necessarily, but you know the question, who shepherds the shepherds, is kind of implicit there. And you can see down here that he actually had double duty or maybe even triple duty. He says, my own hands provided for my own needs and for those with me. And besides all that, I was doing all this work day and night. Like triple duty. Extra work for what he did. So their elders are two, based on Paul's example. Take heed to themselves. Take heed to the flock. Protect from these wolves that will come in. By the way, protect them from one another, the elders that will turn bad from among your own number. watch and warn people night and day. Provide for your own needs and for the needs of others. And finally, look at verse 35. I've shown you in every way, by laboring like this, that you must support the people who are in the pew every Sunday. Those strong members that contribute a lot, that keep the church going. That family that represents the heritage and history of this church. That's who you support? What does it say? You're supporting the weak. Supporting the weak. And there's an image, I think, that maybe fits in here beyond the family that we think about sometimes, and that is the image of a hospital. A hospital. What are hospitals for? It's for sick people. To keep them sick? No, to help them. Can you imagine someone coming to the door of the hospital and they meet the hospital staff meets them at the door and the person says, I'm really sick. I got hurt. And, you know, I am sorry, they would say. You cannot come in here. You will be a drain on our resources. You will use up the time and energy of the people who work here if we let you in. Is that what hospitals do? No, they're just the opposite. That's their role, is to take in the weak. And actually, they even have babies in hospitals, don't they? Why there? Because if something goes wrong, they can protect them and help them come to health. Do we think of the churches that way? Or are we sometimes annoyed when people actually use up resources or distract us or cause us some difficulty or keep us up all night like babies do? I don't mean to be shouting, but you understand, this is a different image. It's supporting the weak. And Paul says, I've labored this way. My example culminates really in this verse in a way. He says, I've shown you in every way, by laboring like this, you must support the weak. And remember the words of the Lord Jesus as He said, it's more blessed to give than receive. You should know that can't be found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, but I believe Jesus said it. And we often quote it, and it's often like it's better to give a birthday present than it is to get one. You know, is that the context of this? Better to give than receive? What's the context here of this giving and receiving? It's the work of the church, which is supporting the weak, that He's shown them in every way they have to do. So here's a better image, a family, a hospital, where sick people are supported. You remember the cocoon thing with Ephesians. Why do we have unity and love and the participation of every member? So we can encourage the studying of Bible in America? Is that the purpose? No, it's for helping the weak. It's for growing children into full grown measure of the stature of fullness of Christ, men. And we get annoyed sometimes. And maybe we look at the leaders and we're judging them by, I don't know, wrong thing. I could whine for a long time. You know, the ladies are not, their skirts are all too short. The elders should do something. You know what I mean? You always fill in the blank. The elders should do something about this, right? Or kids are wild after church or whatever. Is that the work of the church? How we look and see, well, maybe there is a relationship to our spiritual soul. But the point is, it's not this comfort of the congregation, convenience of the building, the growth of the numbers. It's about supporting the weak. Do you see that in this text? I'm begging you to see it. I think that's really what Paul is telling these elders. And that is, it's a spiritual job. And it has to do with babies and sick people and weak people and injured people and people who wander away that you have to go find and drag back because their souls is. That's the work of an elder. You see, I'm kind of back on the sheep shepherding again, aren't I? Even though this is supposed to be a flock shepherding. It's a role that the church has as a whole, and elders lead in that work. So that's what's there. So what's the flock support of this collective leadership? Number one, please shed the worldly views of what the church is. Do not judge these men by how creative, by smart, by visionary, by business acumen, by... Remember what we said about that. That's not in the text. Those qualifications are not really there. Obey and submit. Hebrews 13:17 says that. I'll show you this text. Obey those who rule over you and be submissive. And Russ already mentioned this. We'll say it again too. I think in America especially, we don't like bosses. We don't like, you know, CEOs. And I think our thinking is that the IQ is inversely proportional to your position in the organization. You know, the higher up you get, the dumber you must be. Because we don't understand their work and we don't know what they're doing. It doesn't make sense to us, so it must be wrong, right? And so that's kind of our view. But these are spiritual men. Look at this text. What they watch out for your souls as those who must give an account, as Russ read this before. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable to you. This, their work, is watching for our souls. and not the other things. Okay, so grumbling, okay, if they say that, I'll quit doing it, I'll start doing it, whatever. But I think there's more than that. I'm sorry, I wanted to look at this text. Let's just skip that. So suppress criticism. I think it goes beyond just kind of giving in, saying, okay, I got a boss in the church, but I'll do what I can. 1 Timothy 5 says that that Timothy should not receive an accusation against an elder, except in the mouth of two or three witnesses. I take from that that there's a principle of special protection for the leaders, because it would sow discord. And I'll say maybe a little bit more about this in the sermon, but I'll say this now. When you look at the Israelites and their treatment of Moses, what was the problem there? I mean, the heart of the, you know, their rebellion was directed almost every time against the person of Moses, who was God's selected leader. And sure enough, they were hungry on occasion, and they were thirsty, and they didn't see how they were going to get out of this mess with the Egyptians bearing down. They did not understand that. But when they complained against Moses and made accusations about him, man, did God's wrath come down on them, didn't it? Think about what happened to Korah and even Miriam, for that matter. You know, it was because Moses was so special. Not a perfect man at all, but he stood in the place of God's rule and God's authority in what he was saying. He was guiding the people. And so that's, so I think in light of that, that maybe Timothy's being told, hey, don't support any kind of insubordination or criticism against the elders. There's a special protection. By the way, if they sin, then they get a special punishment in a way. They get reproved in the sight of all. There's a publicity about that that maybe is an example too. So it's two-sided, okay, but still there's a protection that's implied in that text there. And finally, esteem them highly. And this is the verse, we urge you, 1 Thessalonians 5. And I know that the terms for elder is not here, but it seems pretty clear that even though second journey, only a few months later, Paul had to leave Thessalonica under bad circumstances of persecution, they already had some men ruling over them. He says, we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you to esteem them highly in love for their work's sake. Esteem them highly in love because they're the smartest Christians in the whole church. Because they never make a mistake. Right? Because their decision making is better than anybody else's. None of those things. It's not even hardly related to them. It's for their work's sake. It's the thing God has given them to do. That's the source of the esteem. Who made those guys overseers, over which the Holy Spirit has made you over? God revealed the qualifications. He's revealed the work. He's given gifts to men, Ephesians 4. Their work's sake is the reason for esteeming them highly. So sure, obey and submit, suppress criticism. More than that, I think you esteem them highly because they stand in some ways in the place of God. And I think it's in some ways a shadow, really, of our willingness to submit to what God wants us to do. It's imperfect. It's not right to think that the elders are revealing things directly from God. I'm not saying that. But it is, in some sense, a reflection of our willingness to be submissive people to the Master, just like it was in the case of Moses. To submit to them. Why? Because of their work's sake. Esteem them highly because of their work's sake. How do I get off this? I don't have any more jokes or anything, so... But I really appreciate the attention you've given. Anyway, so we're looking forward to morning working with the men.